This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Kelly Ano, who's the Vice President of the Legacy Foundation. The Legacy Foundation, besides supporting projects, including Art House and others involved in the Gary Cities Challenge from the Knight Foundation, has a very unique perspective on the art scene in Gary, and we'll find out more from her on that. We'll also have Carl Lissick with the South Shore Clean Cities to talk about how Indiana's share of billions of dollars from the Volkswagen diesel engine settlement is going to be spent and how some of it could come here to the region. And there's a report that's out from the Richard Fairbanks Foundation and Civic Enterprises talking about some of the challenges that Indiana faces in trying to increase its graduation outcomes for students. We take from time to time an opportunity to have some conversations about, among other things, Art House, the Social Kitchen, which is based in downtown Gary, and many of the projects that are set up within that particular project. Art House, a Social Kitchen, is one of the recipients of the one of the latest Gary Cities Challenge grants from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. The Knight Foundation works very closely with the Legacy Foundation, which is Lake County's own community foundation, to help kind of be a conduit for the funds that come in from the National Foundation and are used here in Gary, Indiana. And with us to talk not only about that and some other areas and kind of give us a wider view of the art scene in the city of Gary, we have Kelly Ano, who is the Vice President with the Legacy Foundation. Thanks for joining us today, Kelly.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
Well, first, let's talk a little bit here about the concept of Art House, of Social Kitchen. We've covered the ideas of it being primarily, I guess, a way to help get people educated in a skill or a profession if they're interested. That is the culinary incubator portion of the facility. There's also a great art gallery that is set up in the building itself, which is right across the street from the Steel Yard Baseball Diamond in Gary. But I think it's just one of many very different aspects of what the art scene is really like in the city of Gary. Tell us where the art scene in Gary seems to be going and some of these other components aside from the Art House itself.
Yeah, there's been a lot of movement in the art scene in Gary recently, and what's been really exciting about that is that it's really been grassroots groups that have been kind of bubbling up with their own energy and their own projects to start making things happen and to really have an impact in the city. And so you have these kind of anchor projects like Art House that are there and are supported by institutions like Knight Foundation and Bloomberg and by the city. Mm-hmm. But then there's also a number of community groups that have been out there and doing projects. So a couple of those are the Decay Devils, which is a group of urban explorers and photographers that has taken on Union Station building to restore it and put arts projects all around the building. And so they've been working throughout the city to be able to photograph and document some of the historical value of the buildings and help clean up the city. The Calumet Artist Residency has been working on the Gary Poetry Project. Mm-hmm. And so if anyone's driven around the city, you'll see their footprint all over with these poems that are done through decorative board ups.
In fact, they've been going to many of the, not all, but many of the abandoned Gary Community School Corporation buildings, taking advantage of the boarded up windows to put up the poems as well. And I know, too, and we've spoken with some of the people involved in it, there's another project that the artists are very much involved in, which is called the Heat, Light, Water Project, which talks about the building in Gary that used to be the known as the Heat, Light, and Water Building, primarily. Mm-hmm. It's a building still standing today, but it's in pretty poor shape. And there have been some efforts as well, along with other buildings, like you mentioned, Union Station, to try to find ways to keep these buildings standing, either fixing them up as much as they can or at least closing them up from the weather so that they don't deteriorate more than they do.
Right. They're looking at how can they preserve these buildings, mm-hmm. which the artist community has really taken on and, in a way, adopted some of them, like the Heat, Light, Water Building, right, and Union Station. And so there's been a lot of kind of energy around those types of projects. So the art and poems that are at the schools were mostly The lines were donated by local students. So the artists went around and had students give lines of poetry on what Gary meant to them, and they put it together into these poetry readings that you can see on the buildings.
I know, too, that there's, and then it's been going on for a number of years, but it seems to have picked up a lot more attention lately, is the public art competition that's underway in downtown Gary. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Legacy Foundation partnered with the City of Gary to launch this project earlier this year. And so we had artists submit their concepts for public poetry or public art, I'm sorry, for public art and open it up to public voting. And so we selected 9 winners for that project, which the first one, actually, Damon Reed just finished his mural last week at 6th and Broadway. So if anyone's driving by, you can take a look at it. And we have 8 more that'll be going up in the spring. And so these are all large-scale public murals and installations that will help to kind of revitalize the look and feel of the city and create a sense of place when you're downtown.
Mm-hmm. What does Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson and her staff there at City Hall think about all of these projects?
They've been a key partner with the artists and with Legacy Foundation in all of these projects. And so they've been really supportive. If we want to, they own a number of the buildings that we've been working on. And so they've been really helpful in helping to remove barriers. And if we have an idea or the artists have an idea for one of these buildings or a project, they just try to work with us to make sure that it can happen.
We mentioned at the outset of our conversation that the Legacy Foundation is sort of the local conduit between the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and Bloomberg Foundation, among others, that work on a national level with their projects, philanthropic and otherwise, working with the local folks here, in particular Gary City Hall, and these people are involved in the recipients, in particular of the Gary City's Challenge Grants. We know right now that there are projects underway. The latest grant recipient is trying to do what they can to help make a dilapidated and in pretty sad-shaped church building into something that will be worth exploring and worth using as another destination point in the city of Gary. What's the latest on how the Church Ruins project is coming along?
Yeah, so that's a really exciting project. The latest Knight Cities Challenge winner in Gary is the City Methodist Ruins Garden. Mm-hmm. And so this is one where it'll be somewhat silent for a little while because we are doing a lot of work behind the scenes. We've hired an architectural engineering group who has gone into the building to be able to assess the structural integrity of the building and determine what can stay, what can be salvaged, what sections would need to come down, and how we can be able to redesign and repurpose and rethink this building in a way that can be a ruins garden that can be used by the community and something that they would actually want and appreciate having there.
I'm glad you mentioned about the ruins garden, because that is one of the key points of the project is to create this this garden space inside what's left of the church building itself. But they also want to be able to set up, I guess, an opportunity for people that that would like to maybe have some type of a service, a ceremony of some type, maybe a wedding reception, just for example, to be able to have that in this facility. But as you say, you have to know how safe the building is and what's going to be able to be usable out of that, don't you?
Right. So after we get the initial results from the architectural engineers, we'll be opening it up to some public sessions where we can find out from the residents and from the community, how would they use this space? So would they use it for weddings? Would they use it for school groups? Would they use it just as a public park or for yoga classes? You know, just finding out what kind of activities do people want to see there that they would actually use it. And so we'll be getting that public feedback. We do have an event coming up on December 8th at 5 o'clock p.m. Downtown Gary, which will be an event that's hosted by the City of Gary Redevelopment to bring awareness to the Ruins Garden Project and get some feedback. And it'll be a holiday lights project where we'll be lighting up City Methodist Church and having a Christmas market, a holiday market there at that time.
That's great. One of the other projects that that the Legacy Foundation has been working very closely with the recipient on the city's grant in particular is the project that is known as Steel City Salvage. That's the not the current one, of course, but the one that was done last year. Delta Institute out of Chicago set that one up and worked hard to get the grant. And in turn, that's what they have taken on, the project of Steel City Salvage. Remind our listeners, if you will, what that's all about and how they've been doing lately.
So Steel City Salvage, they actually just had a big community event last weekend. So that project has been moving forward. And that project is focusing on, as the buildings are being demolished in Gary, they recognize that there was a lot of valuable materials that was going straight to the landfills. And so what they decided to do was to be able to go into these buildings prior to demolition to be able to reclaim and salvage some really valuable things, door frames and brick and tile that they could reuse and be able to sell locally. So they have been getting their warehouse set up, and they're working on training local contractors to be able to learn how to deconstruct. And are training local vendors to be able to learn how to sell and to repurpose the materials.
Now, in the time we have left, Kelly, will you give us an idea of some of the other projects, pardon me, that the Legacy Foundation is working with the local recipients of grants and other projects that we can look forward to here as we get through winter and into the next spring?
Yeah, sure. So last year we worked with Gary Public Transportation on a bus shelter art project where we had a local Gary-based artist submit concepts for art designs to go in the new shelters that will be installed along the new Broadway corridor. And so we hope in the next few months that those installations will be taking place. So as you drive along Broadway there, you'll be able to see these shelters that will be designed by local artists. And then also through Legacy's Neighborhood Spotlight Initiative, we've seen a lot of really community-based projects that have been happening in the downtown Emerson and the Miller neighborhoods of Gary. So there's a Faith Farms Urban Garden in downtown Emerson, Gary, that's really been community-run and a great community garden that's produced quite a bit of food and vegetables for the local residents. And in Miller, there's been a big kind of movement toward volunteerism and projects and kind of artists coming together to be able to take on their local neighborhood.
I think they're probably right now the only arts and cultural district that's even set up in Lake County, and it's right there in the community of Miller, to be
right.
Sure. If anyone's interested in finding out more about these projects and being able to keep track of when these events are coming up, how can they find out more from the Legacy Foundation?
They can feel free to call me at Legacy Foundation or email. My name is Kelly Ano, A-N-O-E, and you can reach me at Legacy Foundation. We're based right here in Merrillville.
Kelly Ano is the Vice President for the Legacy Foundation, which is Lake County's own countywide community foundation. Based here in Merrillville, and we've been listening to some of the topics of interest in the very broad, in fact, maybe to many people, surprisingly broad, art scene in the city of Gary. Thank you very much for spending time to talk about that and the projects that the Legacy Foundation works with other people and other organizations like the Knight Foundation on. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
Program support comes from NIPSCO. The length of your curtains can make a difference on your energy bill. Visit NIPSCO.com/save more to find other unexpected ideas for saving energy around the house.
Sit, relax. Join us Friday for another hour of Let's Eat with me, Chef Nick. Join us around the Thanksgiving table as we sample wines from our special guest, Joseph from Butler Wines out of Chesterton. Call in with any question. Ask us about wines or Thanksgiving dinner preparations. Ask Joseph about his vineyards or secrets about making the best wines. Have a chance to win a gift card. Call in 769-9577. Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Thank you.
Indiana's received a chunk of the money coming in from the settlement for the Volkswagen problems with the emissions controls on vehicles that they had. And a lot of other states were able to take advantage of this Environmental Mitigation Trust Fund. But Indiana's doing pretty well. And to find out where the funds are going to go here in the Hoosier State, let's call on South Shore Clean Cities Executive Carl Lissick to talk about it. Carl, thanks for being with us.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Chris. Thank you very much for having us.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about the problems that Volkswagen managed to get themselves into that in turn led to the litigation and now the settlement and how Indiana is going to be able to take advantage of the share of the settlement monies that they're getting.
Sure. Basically, Volkswagen Corporation, VW, and its subsidiaries, they basically had emission testing defeat devices called. And over 500,000 vehicles across the United States were sold and operated back in the U.S. from 2009. So U.S. EPA has negotiated a settlement with VW, and they're calling it the Partial Settlement Consent Decree. And this settlement would require VW, Volkswagen, to pay about $2.7 billion into this Environmental Mitigation Trust Fund. And so it will offset the excess air pollution emitted by some of these vehicles that Volkswagen had produced that violated what's called the Clean Air Act throughout the United States. So the portion of our state expects to get about $40.9 million from the trust. And this money will be paid over a 3 to 10 year period. So right now, Chris, what we're trying to do is working with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and all of our partners, not only here in northern Indiana, but across the state, is looking at opportunities how we can potentially leverage this money and help with the cleanup of dirty diesel. And what this is specific to is nitrous oxides, and look at programs and plans that is going to help us reduce diesel emissions across the state of Indiana.
Well, it's interesting that the state of Indiana should be able to use this fund that's come about because of the settlement here over the faulty VW diesel vehicles and turn it into something to help clean up our air from our own vehicles that we have here in the Hoosier State.
Absolutely. And, it is exciting. I mean, this is really, we've been working diligently with other state partners, here in Northwest Indiana, just looking at ways of reducing not only diesel emissions, but vehicle emissions in general. And this program potentially would help us alleviate some of those emission requirements. And collectively, working with just a whole slew of partners, looking at opportunities that are going to create economic development, that are going to create jobs, that are going to create just things that are going to help with, like I said, diesel emissions here in Lake Porter and LaPorte County. So we're really excited about just this opportunity to work with partners. We're excited about because this is going to affect not only nonprofits, governmental entities, but it's also going to affect working with private business owners. So anybody that drives a diesel vehicle has the opportunity to really be part of a plan here in Northwest Indiana that's going to help not only potentially replace some of these dirty diesel vehicles, but it's also going to do it at a very rewarding potential price. And so right now what the state is doing, Chris, is the state is beginning to take public comments in regards to how this money potentially could be spent throughout our state. And so there's a variety of categories that we're working on. So let me just highlight some of those categories.
Yeah.
So over-the-road trucks like Class A trucks and port trucks, school buses, shuttle buses, transit buses, local freight trucks, locomotives, what are called diesel switcher locomotives. Money's also going to be available for upgrade of eligible diesel-powered ships and tugboats in and around Lake Michigan. There'll be partnerships for our airports for replacing eligible diesel-powered airport ground support equipment. This will also be available for eligible forklifts and different types of handling equipment in industry. And then it's also going to potentially for light-duty, zero-emission vehicles and charging stations here in and around Indiana. So we anticipate that the state will be an all-inclusive, that they're looking at ways that this is going to help not just in Northwest Indiana, but across the state. And so currently what we're hoping to do is between now and probably the spring of 2018, assist the state in hosting a variety of public meetings where they can garner public input on how this money potentially should be spent. And what we're trying to do is work with all the different partnerships that we have to put a plan together that would be not only assist these organizations, but help assist diesel emissions here in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties.
Do you think that with this plan in place here in Northwest Indiana, it not only will make it easier to be able to take advantage of the settlement funds that the state is getting and can divvy out to Northwest Indiana, as well as helping the businesses, the non-governmental entities, governmental agencies, whoever that happens to have equipment that runs on diesel, to be able to replace the dirty diesel with a cleaner MUFA?
I totally believe that. And again, working with our local metropolitan planning organizations like NERPC and MACOG, the Michigan Area Council of Governments, we've been doing a variety of education events to introduce people to different alternative fuel vehicles, to different clean diesel types of activities. And unfortunately, what happens a lot of times, Chris, is a lot of private industry does not know that they can take advantage of some of these activities. And that's really our goal, is how we can collectively work together between government, nonprofits, and for-profit industries to really have a very good plan put together for Northwest Indiana. And that's really what we hope our role to be, is that we can be a facilitator of some of these different projects, and look at ways that we can leverage other funding to just clean up our air here in Northwest Indiana.
That's great. Now, if anybody's interested, or if they know of people that might be able to take part in this particular program and should know about what's available out there, how can they find out more? And in turn, you'll be able to pass them on to the right agencies, and better still, help get their input as well to go into what needs to be taken care of. How can they find out more now?
Sure, the best way to get a hold of us, Chris, would be through SouthShoreCleanCities.org, our website, or they can call our office at 219-644-3690. And like I said, Chris, our role definitely is to be a facilitator with all these different agencies. I think you're going to hear a lot of propaganda coming from across the United States, because this is going to affect the entire United States. And I would say, you know, our best resource here locally will be South Shore Clean Cities, working with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management to give updates, and working with, our metropolitan planning organizations. And so we plan on hosting a variety of meetings and different stakeholder types of activities. So it doesn't have to be the replacement of a vehicle to an alternative fuel vehicle. It can be diesel to diesel. And so, as we look at some of our economic and some of our growth opportunities here in Northwest Indiana, we're going to be working alongside a lot of our economic development folks and look at ways that we can leverage not only this funding, but other funding that we can take advantage of and clean up the air here in Northwest Indiana.
Carl Lissick is Executive Director of the South Shore Clean Cities. And as always, Carl, thanks for being with us with the information. And I hope that folks look at the website, find out more, and put their input in here to let everybody know how they can better help participate in an effort now and taking advantage of these funds that don't come around very often. And it was only because of the settlement with Volkswagen that Indiana has been able to take advantage of that. Thanks very much for giving us the update.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana lawmakers have been involved in recent sessions on dealing with the problems of making sure that public school students have the right kind of testing and in turn get the right kind of education that in turn will lead to more graduations, attendees, as well as better jobs for Northwest Indiana and the rest of the state. But part of the report that has come out recently looks into how the improvements can continue, in particular with the graduation rate and how the best practices can be set up and meet the challenges of such areas as racial equality and urban education. The recent study that has been commissioned by the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, which is a nonprofit based in central Indiana, that has a mission to advance the vitality of Indianapolis and well-being of its residents, took on the project with the help of research and policy firm Civic Enterprises. And the report that has come out this week is entitled Closing the Graduation Gap. With us to talk about it, we have a senior research and policy advisor for Civic Enterprises, Dr. Jennifer DePauli. Dr. DePauli, thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little first here about the concerns. What, in turn, the Fairbanks Foundation had asked Civic Enterprises to do the research in trying to increase the graduation rate here in Indiana in particular and in the communities around the state.
Sure. So, I mean, some of the concerns that, like you said, the Fairbanks Foundation mentioned and some things that we were interested in is, you know, on the plus side, Indiana is the state that across the board, across the nation, has the lowest graduation rate gap between its low-income and non-low-income students. So that was one thing that we really wanted to understand a little bit more of, maybe why that was happening. And as we dug into the data, we started seeing that though that's a really positive step in the right direction and something that a lot of other states haven't been able to achieve, there are significant graduation gaps, as you said. There are significant racial gaps that we're seeing and other gaps, including, you know, students with disabilities. And then, you know, one of the other big things that I think a lot of people we have expressed concern with were these waiver diplomas and whether or not students were actually graduating with the right, you know, the right coursework, the right classes that were going to make them successful beyond high school. So that's really where we started looking.
Mm-hmm. We know that just recently the state-appointed graduation pathways panelists made some recommendations to be able to add graduation requirements here in Indiana, including picking up some additional credentials and college entrance exams and the like. When you did the research, did you find that there were many communities, many school districts in the state that needed to make the improvements, not only in Indianapolis and central Indiana, which is where a lot of the research came from, but maybe some other places like here in northwest Indiana in particular that in turn could find the ways to make the graduation rates increase as you do and make them more equitable between black students and white students and Hispanics and others that are attending the schools?
Yeah, so the way that I would address that is that, you know, we did see some things going on in some of these districts that are trying to make things more equitable and that are trying to, you know, make sure students have these pathways. We saw it in the Indianapolis and Marion County area. We see it in Fort Wayne. We see it down in Evansville. You know, some of these districts that we actually were able to get into. Where I think we're a little bit troubled and where we look at, you know, we were really focused on the state data is that, you know, especially in terms of equity, when you're looking at rigor, we don't necessarily know from publicly available data who's getting those, like, general diplomas, so the lower than core 40 diplomas,
right?
And who is actually getting the waivers. You know, so we actually do have some waiver data based on race, ethnicity, and low income. But, you know, that's where we would be most concerned. Are these students being tracked into lower, lower tiers of what their diploma is going to be at the end? And, you know, we applaud the state of Indiana for trying to raise rigor because we do know that it has an effect. And, you know, colleagues of ours at the Alliance for Education actually have put a report out recently as well, putting Indiana at the top in terms of, you know, a state that has defaulted students into a core 40 diploma, so a college-ready and career-ready diploma, and then showing how that diploma and that higher level of rigor is actually translating into less remediation at the post-secondary level and higher rates of completion in terms of getting a college a degree or whether it's a two-year degree or four-year degree. And so that is something that we think is really positive. What we would want to see more and what we think could actually help in terms of, like you said, at the district level, understanding what is going on in terms of these equity gaps that we see is who is being taken out of that core 40 pathway and being put into a lower level pathway, or who are the students who are getting the waivers that may actually be reducing the rigor and then, you know, having these inequitable results as a as the outcome.
Mm-hmm. I know that we have been talking here primarily about public education and maybe even charter schools, but I know that that everybody, including you folks there that have been doing the research and the Fairbanks Foundation, were very concerned about how homeschooled students are doing. They don't always have the information that's available to find out how these students are progressing along once they get involved in homeschool, or if they've gone through their entire education as homeschooled students. They don't know how for sure they're going to do is whether they're going to graduate, so to speak, from whatever the classes they've been taking.
Yeah, and like you said, the tricky part about it is we just don't have data to tell us what is happening with those students. And from our report, when we're looking just at graduation rate data, that is only students who, you know, who are in high school and who have then been removed from their graduating cohort using the code that Indiana likes to use that basically says they've been removed by a parent. And that means that that's the default code for homeschooling. Mm-hmm. So we have all of these students who are entering the ninth grade, but sometime between the time that they're in the ninth grade and the 12th grade, they're being removed for homeschooling, and we just don't know what's happening with those students. And like you said, you know, students can obviously be removed from homeschool as early as elementary school. I mean, students can start in homeschooling, and we don't have data on them. But I think we get a little more concerned that all of a sudden students in the 9th or the 10th or the 11th grade or even the 12th grade are suddenly being exited out of their cohort, and we just don't know where they're going and what kind of education they're actually receiving once they leave. And that to us, is a very big concern.
We're talking with Dr. Jennifer DePauli, who is a senior research and policy advisor for Civic Enterprises, which, along with the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, worked together to put out the report that is out there now, which is entitled Closing the Graduation Gap. And you mentioned earlier, Dr. DePauli, about the fact that there are several central Indiana school districts and even the ones in Fort Wayne that have helped participate in the research that you all did. Will mm-hmm. you take a few minutes and explain some of the things that you found these school districts are doing right to be able to be on that road to closing the gap in the graduation rates?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of people want to know what is like the one thing that they can do to improve their schools. And our answer is there is no one thing. There's no magic solution. These are things that take time. And these are things that have to be implemented, you know, pretty faithfully. And like we said, we want them to be using evidence-based things. So some of the things that we saw, so for example, in Indianapolis Public Schools, they have just started within the past couple of years starting to use, you know, looking at chronic absenteeism, which is also something that when you look at the national level, states who are submitting their Every Student Succeeds Act, you know, state plans, so many are focusing on chronic absenteeism because we know how important it is that students are in school. I mean, it seems pretty obvious. If students are not actually in the classroom, they cannot learn. And so, you know, we would applaud, you know, Indianapolis Public Schools for starting to take that initiative to look at chronic absenteeism as early as kindergarten, and also to make parents aware of how important it is that their students are not missing days. You know, here or there, you know, we know that if they miss more than 10% of school, they're not going to do well. Mm-hmm. When you look at a school district like, you know, Evansville, you know, they have been focusing on a lot of different things. They've been doing a lot of really interesting school turnaround work, but they have taken it on themselves to really focus on social and emotional learning. So to focus on building relationships with students, to make sure that the school climate is one that is, you know, welcoming to students. You know, these are things that we know are really important. Students need to feel like they have a place in that school and they belong, and that the adults in that school care about them. It seems like pretty basic stuff, but that's just the reality of it. And then, you know, we look at a school like or a district like Fort Wayne, like you said. Fort Wayne is a really interesting district and one I think a lot of people in Indiana pay attention to that have really done a lot of hard work over many, many years to put a lot of those pieces together. So they're using early warning indicators, which one piece of that is the chronic absenteeism.
Right.
They're looking at connecting kids to college and career pathways. They're looking at making sure they have those strong positive relationships. So they're really taking a lot of what is going on the national stage in terms of research and really trying to make sure that those things are all fitting in together to make sure that kids are engaged in the ninth grade and want to stay in school and on track to graduate.
We know that Governor Eric Holcomb, in some of his comments that he made recently, giving his sort of legislative agenda for the next General Assembly session that starts in January, talked about workplace development to be sure that the jobs are for the future are there. And, of course, that does bring, of course, education into it. And I know, too, that some of the school districts that you folks have studied have found ways to be able to be sure that high schoolers, maybe if they're not going to go directly into the workplace after they get their graduation ceremony is finished, get their diploma, but they are going to want to continue their education some way or another. And you have to find a way to be able to link that classroom learning to the careers of the future, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, how do you get students interested or, you know, young people interested in those career pathways? Expose them to those pathways while they're in high school. You know, so that can be that CTE coursework that we talk about, the career technical education. It could also be as simple as, you know, when we think of, you know, workplace skills, a lot of times those skills are things like building communication, problem solving, being able to work in teams. Those are skills that should just be part of everyday education that help students move into that workplace, that maybe they're not getting the technical skills, but they're still getting those skills that make them successful either in college or in careers. So like you said, I mean, we think it's so important that kids just, you know, we don't want to track students into any one path, but we want to give them exposure to the things that may, you know, light a fire under them and get excited about, you know, something that they can do in their future beyond high school.
There have been some Northwest Indiana school districts that have gotten together and taking advantage of the Lilly Endowment's comprehensive counseling institutions to come up with ways to have workshops set up for counselors in particular that need additional help, and maybe, I guess, even social workers, too, if they are involved in the schools in some way, to help give them a little extra education. Do you think that some of the recommendations that come out of this report, closing the graduation gap, will be able to be a best use to some of the counselors to make their jobs easier?
Yeah, we hope so. I mean, you know, when we see schools that are successful, they're including a much larger group than just counselors, but counselors are play an integral role. And like you said, when we were in some of these schools in your state, we saw counselors trying to take on all these roles, connecting students to career pathways, making sure they were on track to graduate, you know, using that data. So I think any education, any extra money that can go towards helping counselors bring certain initiatives into the school and helping, you know, teachers carry them out and to help, you know, build that foundation, I think is incredibly important. And I think something that, and I know you said, you know, this is from the Lilly Endowment, mm-hmm. and we think it's so important that they're giving money to help, you know, fix that counselor problem in Indiana, because counselors are very important and play a really, really important role. And, you know, I hope that schools are taking advantage of it, like you said, to get more counselors in schools and to make sure that they have the tools they need to succeed.
Now, Dr. DePauli, if anyone's interested in finding out more about the report, getting a copy of the report, closing the graduation gap, tell us, if you will, how they can get it.
Sure. So they can find it on our website at www.civicenterprises.net. And I know we also have been tweeting out about it, and I know the Fairbanks Foundation has been you know, putting it out there as well. So lots of different places you can find the report.
Dr. Jennifer DePauli, thank you for being with us to talk about this today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Jennifer DePauli is a senior research and policy advisor for Civic Enterprises, which is a co-author of a report that was put out by the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation based in Indianapolis. The report is called Closing the Graduation Gap, and it helps highlight some of the key challenges that the state of Indiana faces in graduation outcomes and ways to address these challenges. The Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte County, founded with the proceeds from the sale of LaPorte County Hospital, recently handed out its first grants, and the PAC Center in LaPorte was labeled to use $204,800 toward its latest project, which is called the Brighton Street Green Space. We talked recently with Pastor Nate Laux in LaPorte about the center and about the projects, and here's the conversation that we had.
We have to go back to 2010 when we opened our church in downtown LaPorte, and one of the things we wanted to do is figure out where the deepest need in our community was, and we noticed there's a problem with food insecurity, and so we just opened a food pantry by putting some just a sign out in our front yard that said, you know, free food, and We had about 300 people that showed up that first month. And fast forward now, and the PAX Center has grown out of that. PAX is, of course, Latin for peace. We believe we have a profound and sacred call to be peacemakers in La Porte. And so we feed over about 12 to 1,300 people a month through our food pantry, and we feed a couple hundred people a month in our community meals. We have a community garden system now as well, where we teach kids and give community garden plots to different community members in low-income areas, and lots of different kinds of ways to combat food insecurity and food scarcity in La Porte.
Now, when the center first got started, and the food pantry in particular got started back in 2015, where did you get the food to be able to offer it back to the community?
Yeah, so you know, our church's mission is to help people in the community, and so we dedicate a significant portion of what we get in each week through our weekly giving to this kind of justice project. But we also, of course, part of my roles in the organization is to go out and get grants and get help from other organizations, other churches, and things like that. And then through the USDA, through programs like Feeding America, we get good purchasing power so that we can buy significant amounts of food at a reduced rate through programs like, through the Northwest Indiana Food Bank, these kind of things.
I was going to ask if you take advantage of the food bank, probably rely on them a lot, as do a lot of agencies now rely on the food bank and based in Gary to be the source of a lot of the items that you get in. But I know, too, that you work very hard, and one of the projects that you have been most proud of is a community garden, which, of course, when the weather is right, can produce a lot of vegetables and fruits and the like that in turn can be turned back into ways to help feed the public.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, oftentimes food pantries can provide food, but it's really just kind of a Band-Aid to help hunger, but not actually helping people live healthier lives or combat some other issues like health-related issues. Typically, the cheapest food that we can buy is also some of the worst food we can give each other.
Yeah.
But
right, so
it's still food, though. So, you know, that's a good thing. I don't want to be too cynical about that, because that's still a good thing. Anytime you can provide food for people that are hungry, regardless of good or bad, it's a good thing. However, we wanted to hopefully, you know, take that a little step further and help provide access to better food. And so we've done this through our community garden. We had over 40 kids in a community garden program this year, a summer program where they came together and they gardened. They had their own garden box and they had lunch every week together, and they learned all kinds of things about environmental sustainability. They learned about, you know, community development. But we also had 50 boxes for community members that they used. And then we have this area where we call a U-pick area, where anybody in the community that needs can come and pick out of the garden. And then finally, at the Jackson Street Community Garden, we have a share table. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the more popular things that we do. Essentially, it's just providing access for people that have to give to people that might not. And so, you know, at the end of the season, somebody planted a lot of tomatoes or a lot of cucumbers, and none of their friends want any of it anymore, and they've got an abundance coming out of their ears. But our share table, they can bring that there, and then we provide a place for people in need to come get from people that have extra.
I'm sure this is one really, really good way to be able to fight the problem of food deserts. We know that urban areas, although La Porte County is not considered an urban area, it's all part of the greater Northwest Indiana region, and we do know that there are food deserts that do exist here where residents aren't living close enough or don't have the opportunity to be able to get the kinds of foods they need for good nutrition as well as to take care of their families. So this, I'm sure, is a good battle against food deserts.
Yeah, absolutely. So our new project, the Brighton Street Green Space, is right located in the smack of a food desert here in downtown La Porte. Mm-hmm. And like you said, we're this kind of unique community that has rural sensibilities, but also kind of a downtown urban feel in some areas. And so it's kind of hard to identify La Porte specifically as what we are. Are we urban? Are we rural? But we do have a food desert that's a fairly significant part of our downtown area. And so we are starting a new community garden, but it's a green space, so it'll have a building on it, which is our Education Resource Center, which will be able to do more projects like canning and pickling and different kind of education projects for the community, but also kind of increase our green space, increase our footprint for gardening. The demand wasn't able to, we weren't able to keep up with the demand, rather, at the Jack Street project, which is about six blocks away. And so we'll be able to increase our capacity for care at this place. We're very excited about it.
We're talking with Pastor Nate Laux, who is the pastor of the State Street Community Church. He's also involved, of course, in the leadership of the PAX Center at the site, and along with all the community gardens that's set up there and the food pantry that's located there in the port, establishing the new Brighton Street Green Space Project. You mentioned, Pastor Laux, that there's going to be an education resource center, a building that's going to be there. What are the plans for that?
Yeah, so, the current spot has a fairly large former dairy factory on it. And if you talk to anybody that's been in La Porte for many years, they probably remember when there was an ice cream shop there and it was actually active. But for the last many years, it hasn't. And so it's kind of urban blight. It's run down. There's parts of it that are falling down. But there is a section of that building. We're going to tear down most of it, but there's a section that we can save and salvage. And so we're going to remodel that building and turn it into an education resource center. And we will be partnering with other health-related organizations for different classes there, different types of, health-related partnerships, screenings, these kind of things. But we'll also use it for some of our STEM-related education. Right now, our programs typically are geared around elementary, rather. And we want to, as our elementary kids graduate out of our programs, we want to have perhaps some more middle school or high school education. So it'll provide some space for that as well, but also different classes. You grew all those tomatoes, you grew all those cucumbers, and we want to teach you how to pickle. We want to teach you how to can, these kind of things, so that what you grew over the summer can hopefully last you throughout the winter, or at least come close to it.
Now, what's the timetable that you've set up there amongst your colleagues going on this project to get things going?
Much of it's contingent on funds, like any kind of nonprofit funding, and it's an ambitious project. Anytime you have to take down a building and mitigate the land and get that all prepared, just to get started on this, you're $100,000 plus. And however, we are seeking partners, and the church, State Street Community Church, and the PAC Center are, of course, going to put in a significant amount of money towards this project. The goal would be for us to start demolition of the current facility this winter and start remodeling our Education Resource Center. And it'd probably be a two-year timeline before the whole space is done. A lot of it's volunteer-led, again, contingent on community and business partners to help us fundraise and fund it. But if all goes well, hopefully within the next 2 years, it will all be finished. We will have space, just to be sure, though. We will continue to use it as we go, though.
Now, if anybody's interested in finding out more, if they'd like to follow the progress of the project, how can they do that?
Yeah, please do. Visit us at the PAX Center, PAX is PAX.com, or go and search for us online on Facebook, the PAX Center, or go on Twitter. And okay. We're on there as well. And you can find us, and we, of course, update that as soon as there's updates for the project. And feel free to contact us if you'd like to help or find out more.
Pastor Nate Laux, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Nate Laux is the pastor of the State Street Community Church. He's also the chief peace officer and president of the PAC Center. And we've been finding out about how improvements in the center of La Porte are going to make a difference and help feed the community and fight food insecurity and in turn make La Porte a better community to live in. Congress and the Trump administration are discussing broad cuts for many areas and programs, and they include the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, also known as food stamps. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports a number of Hoosiers insist that there can be no cuts to the program, and they're working to make sure that message is heard. And for one person, that meant some rather drastic measures.
It's been over a week since Dave Miner's hunger strike started.
Yesterday there was a pitch-in lunch at church, and I walked down there and I saw that table with all that great food, and I'm like, oh!
Miner is a self-described hunger activist and relief advocate. We met at the St. Vincent de Paul food pantry on Indianapolis's east side to illustrate the need for food assistance. More than one out of every 10 Hoosiers is food insecure.
We're standing amidst huge piles of food. But the striking thing is not only the wonderful work that they do, but that this represents about 3% of the total food provided to people in Marion County.
SNAP provided direct food assistance to nearly 750,000 Hoosiers last year. And Miner says no part of the hunger puzzle can go missing.
We need public and private. We need faith-based and secular. We need for-profit and not-for-profits. And the federal meals run between 80 and 90% of the total. So the federal meals are essential.
His fast lasted 16 days, about 50 meals, to represent the 50 million meals lost for Hoosiers if there are SNAP cuts. But those cuts aren't a done deal. Jessica Fraser with the Indiana Institute for Working Families follows the issue closely for the people she serves.
Families who are on SNAP do work. SNAP also supports a lot of children and senior citizens.
77% of Hoosier SNAP families have at least one member who is employed. Yet many of those families still live below the poverty line. Between President Trump's proposed budget, Senate resolutions, larger tax reform, or the Farm Bill, the talk of SNAP cuts varies greatly. But Fraser says the House has proposed $150 billion in cuts over 10 years is striking.
You know, the total number in the federal budget is this ginormous, multi-hundred billion dollar amount. But the average amount of food that a person gets per month is $117 worth of food.
Emily Weicker-Bryan is the executive director for Feeding Indiana's Hungry. She recently traveled to Washington and met with members of Congress. She told them that every $5 in SNAP benefits generates $9 in economic impact.
It's not cash assistance. It's not savings. It's not going into a bank account. It's benefit that is designed and can be only used to purchase food.
She's heard the argument that since the number of SNAP recipients is down, cuts could be made. But she points out not everyone has shared in economic recovery.
Our unemployment numbers in Indiana look good, but it's not the folks who are unemployed that are the ones that are still needing help.
Weicker-Bryan says the issue of hunger is directly linked to all aspects of well-being.
To make sure kids are going to be able to be attentive and present in school, to make sure that adults are going to be a vital part of their workforce, and for folks who may have, you know, medical issues or disabilities or seniors.
It was during Dave Miner's hunger strike that she attended a luncheon with him and Governor Eric Holcomb.
That's great timing.
But I asked if I could have his dessert.
She said the opportunity to keep the issue front of mind matters.
To keep having that conversation and to highlight this issue that we still have a significant part of our friends and neighbors who don't know where that next meal is coming from.
There should be a clearer picture of what SNAP cuts might look like by the end of the year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for joining us. Coming up tomorrow, Reporters Roundtable Thursday is back, and we'll have reporters Dan Carton, Ed Bierschenk, Joseph Pete, and Bill Dolan from the Times of Northwest Indiana to talk about the stories that they've worked on and put out in print and online. We hope you can join us for that.